Time to see if I need to keep my head down. It's not looking good. I am squarely in the frame of the photograph that accompanies the lead news item on the BBC News website. Recognisably me, even in casual mufti with a rat's nest under my beret. The same video clip is on YouTube. It has been viewed 223,195 times already. Make that 223,196. There are links to 6 more videos of the incident, from different angles. One of them was taken by a Korean tourist whose funky high-def camera had some sort of bizarre polarising filter that is sensitive to thaw fields, bolts of psychedelic lightning zig and zag across the concourse, roughly connecting Lecter to Laughing Boy, who shows up in luminous green. There's an interview with the mayor from his hospital bed, breathlessly expressing his gratitude and admiration to the redhead with the violin, who took down Stripjack Sprat, as the supervillain Monkey apparently calls himself. Alias? Dougal Slaithwaite, age 52, unemployed, of no fixed abode, now facing charges of kidnapping, indecent assault, and threatening behaviour. There are linked news items, human interest colour I gather, about other superhero outbreaks. Who ordered that? Apparently my media habit is sufficiently out of the mainstream that I've been missing out on the summer's big story. There are more than 70 messages waiting for me in my Facebook inbox. I delete them all. Another one appears almost immediately. I log out. I don't bother checking the newspapers. Instead, I repack my suitcase, adding my second best suit in place of the one I'm wearing. It may be some time before I can come home without running a gauntlet of journalists. The first of them may already be on their way depending on how good they are at image manipulation and social engineering. As I said, Sis is in for a real surprise next time she checks in. But for me, it's time to face the music. I phone for a cab, and they pick me up at my front door. My skin's crawling as I do the perp walk out to the curb, but there are no tabloid reporters or paparazzi waiting in the bushes yet. It's a lucky escape that I can't count on repeating. I feel nauseous as I contemplate what's coming up next. An auto-da-fé, if I'm lucky. Utter shame otherwise. Of course the cabbie turns out to be the talkative kind. "Did you hear about the mess in Trafalgar Square?" he asks. "I'm going to have to loop around to drop you on Pall Mall. That end's all blocked off. One of those supervillains went off his trolley and kidnapped the mayor. Then some girl with a magic guitar took him down right in front of Nelson's Column. The news is saying she works for a secret government agency," he confides with a knowing look. "I'm sure she does." I cross my arms and peer out of the window, feigning boredom. I'm certain he can hear my pulse pounding over the noise of the lorry we're nose to tail with. "Stands to reason. The government must have some kind of plan for dealing with them, right?" He sounds worried. "Them? Yeah, the crazies with superpowers." "Crazies with..." I catch his eye in the mirror, looking at me as if he's wondering what planet I'm from. "Yeah, crazies. Like the bloke what tore up that community centre in Tooting last week, with his bare hands. It's anarchy, that's what it is, even with all these crime fighters and pervert suits coming out the woodwork." "Pervert suits?" I ask, caught by his phrasing. "Yeah, it's like there's some kind of law or something. Ordinary bloke acquires the power to turn his head into a teapot. He has to start poncing around in lycra and fishnets. Like something from the Rocky Horror, innit? You know what? That sort of thing turns my stomach. There ought to be a law against it." "What? Turning your head into a teapot?" "No, the pervy suits. I mean, no offence, if a fit bird with superpowers wants to wear a skimpy dress and thigh-high boots, I've got no problem, know what I mean? But some of these blokes, they're a bit past their sell-by. There ought to be a law about it, right? They should make all the fat supervillains wear burkas. But they ain't doing anything about any of it right now, looks like. It's a crime. The police should do something. And so on, and on, and on, for approximately 25 minutes. By the time we arrive at the Admiralty, my cheek is twitching, and if I had my choice of superpowers, I would cheerfully sell my soul for the ability to turn my driver's head into a cafetiere. I'm so tense by the time we arrive that I forget to ask for a receipt when I pay. But swearing won't help, and I don't feel like running after the taxi, so I make my way stiffly to the front desk, where a splendidly uniformed doorman waits behind a desk carved from the timbers of an 18th century man-o-war. I present my warrant card. Dr. O'Brien, I'm here for a meeting in room 4102. It sounds so much better than disciplinary hearing. If you'd care to sign here, ma'am. Now stare into the camera just for a second. It's one of the ubiquitous eyeball on a stock webcams, disquietingly like something I once met in a hotel hallway in Amsterdam. I try to will the lens to crack, but I'm not quite ugly enough. Jolly good. Now I'm just going to print you out a badge. Remember to wear it at all times and return it when you leave. I'm afraid you'll have to leave those bags here. You can check them into the cloakroom, but I'm afraid we'll have to scan them. You can take the suitcase, but the violin has to stay with me. I put it on the desk. You're welcome to inspect it right here, but I can't let it out of my possession. It's rather valuable. I tense up, anticipating a fight.
Really?
He smiles over gilt-framed half-moon glasses.
Well, if you insist, I can hand-search it.
Bless the Corps of Commissioners. They're ex-military enough to know when to bend the rules. We deposit my suitcase. I show him Lecter, and let him hand-check the sides and back of the case. Then I take my badge, and go in search of the borrowed conference room. It's funny how the mere anticipation of a verbal confrontation can be worse than life-and-death combat. My stomach is hollow, and chest a little fluttery. The floors in this building are paved in Italian marble, uncarpeted, utterly lethal if you slip, and liable to cause permanent hearing damage if you walk on them for too long in heels. It's enough to make me long for the beige institutional carpet of the new annex. And then I'm standing in front of a pair of imposing black double doors, framed by Corinthian columns, surmounted by an arch with painted putti, blowing on the sails of ships of the line. I take a deep breath and knock. Twice. Vikram opens the door. He looks nearly as nervous as I feel.
Oh, good. We were getting worried,
he says.
Worried? Is there a problem?
I ask cautiously.
Yes, we've been running interference from upstairs, but...
He steps backwards.
Come on in. We have coffee and refreshments.
I follow him into the room. It's about the size of an aircraft carrier's hangar deck, with baroque gilt-encrusted benches and side tables drawn up against wood-paneled walls that have fossilized under the weight of their decorative plasterwork. The floor-to-ceiling windows admit a waterfall of golden afternoon light that floods the room and washes across a hand-woven Persian carpet that must have cost a prince's ransom.
Ah, Dr. O'Brien.
I nearly jump out of my skin. It's Dr. Michael, never a Mike, Armstrong, the senior auditor. He smiles like a tired crocodile.
What a relief. Are you well?
I manage not to stagger under the weight of his regard. He actually looks concerned.
Have you spoken to Bob this morning?
I ask.
Yes. Wait, not since the early hours.
His left eyebrow wrinkles.
Is something the matter?
I glance round. He's brought a couple of admin bodies I don't know, but some faces I expected to see are absent. Yes, but I'm not sure it's relevant to the matter in hand.
Where's Judith?
Dead.
What? Armstrong clasps his hands behind his back, as sober as a funeral director.
Last night, during the Code Red, we were attacked at the new annex.
I knew that, but... Judith!
Dr. Carroll was the second-ranking auditor who dealt with our department. I was expecting her to chair this session. She wasn't exactly a friend, but I was certain I'd get a fair hearing from her. And to learn that she's dead so recently comes like a punch in the guts. He looks at me, his expression deceptively mild.
We lost others.
Oh my God.
Andrew Newstrom, Doris Goodman, James Angleton.
Oh my.
My knees nearly give way. Everything's a blur. The next thing I know, the senior auditor has my arm. He's almost holding me up and is leading me towards a chair.
God.
It's not that it's entirely news to me. I knew we'd lost Angleton. But the scale of it hits me hard. And Andy was a friend, not a close one, but a friend nonetheless.
God won't help you, I'm afraid,
the SE murmurs sympathetically. More loudly.
I'm sorry, you should have been kept informed.
But... Andy?
Yes.
I feel the hard edge of a chair butt up against my legs. I allow myself to collapse onto it.
Your husband is picking up the pieces.
But he's...
My lips don't seem to want to work properly. I take a few seconds to get them back under control.
This is a catastrophe.
Yes, he agrees.
It puts everything that's happened to me in the past 24 hours in a new perspective. Tilt shift mode, on a shiny new digital camera. All of a sudden, your larger-than-life problems look like a miniature diorama.
Oh, God.
Bob and I had a huge row if I'd known.
Not to worry,
Dr. Armstrong murmurs gently. He sits down beside me.
I'm sure allowances will be made. Accommodations can be reached, but that's not what we're here for, is it?
Oh, that.
No,
I agree.
You know what's coming next.
It's a statement, not a question.
Give me a couple of seconds, please. This is all a bit of a shock.
I reach for the empty chair on my other side and lay Lecter's case there. I try to relax, even though every instinct tells me to tense up. What's coming next is one of the scariest non-violent experiences you can undergo, and if you work for the laundry, you will undergo it, sooner or later.
I'm ready now.
I turn my head and stare into his eyes, which are deep and brown, and have unusually long lashes.
All right. Sabbath, Claymore, Diamond, Rocket. Execute sit-rep 1.
My tongue feels like a lump of wood. My eyes do not belong to me. Something inside my head uses my larynx to make its report. Subjective integrity is maintained. Subjective continuity of experience is maintained. Subject observes no tampering.
Good.
The senior auditor smiles warmly.
Execute sit-rep 2.
Subjective operational readiness state, green. Subjective background state, amber. Trending to red.
Hmm.
His smile slips.
Exit supervision.
A brief pause.
Mo, before we get to the main business of this meeting, in your own words, how was your trip going? Before you were recalled, was there a message for us?
The unseen narrator using my vocal cords goes back to sleep. I clear my throat as I regain control of my own mind.
Ramona invited me to come visit sometime. We had a lengthy gossip sesh. But that's all. Nothing substantial. Nice to know the neighbors are steady.
The set of his shoulders relaxes slightly.
So, tell me what happened in Trafalgar Square.
My shoulders tense. Total screw-up, I'm afraid. I went in under-informed and under-equipped, and didn't even notice the news crew until it was way too late. Also, I'd like to report that I had some self-control issues. Nearly took out my personal frustration on the idiot who caused the scene. Utterly unconscionable. And I was able to stop myself, but... You need to know. He raises a hand, and I manage to stop myself before I begin to babble. Then he speaks, his voice low and soothing. You dealt with a crisis while sleep-deprived, and in the wake of a major domestic argument, and you dealt with it effectively. Did you rough him up? If not, I see no problem here except that perhaps the DO should have looked a little further before assigning assets to deal with what appeared, at first, to be a trivial distraction. That you feel the need to confess that you attempted is creditable, but, under the circumstances, unnecessary. We do not punish people for thought crime, Dr. O'Brien. He pauses. And in any event, we would have encountered this particular crisis sooner or later, regardless of who had to deal with the feckless Mr. Spratt. It was just bad luck that it happened to you, rather than to someone else. What crisis? I pause long enough to lick my lips. The code red? Dealt with, he says, with a dismissive wave of the hand. The fangs are locked down tight. The external and internal threats have been neutralized. For a moment, there's a flicker of fire in his eyes. And damage control is in hand. No, this isn't the disciplinary hearing you are expecting. We have another crisis to deal with. He gestures at the boardroom table at the far end of the room. So, whenever you're ready. Chapter 4 Briefings. It takes a few minutes, but eventually everybody is seated around the table. I'm about to go to the foot of it, but the SA shakes his head and directs me towards a seat immediately to his left, and he's chairing it. Mr. Chowdhury, if you'd like to start the briefing. Vikram clears his throat. He looks worried. Do we have time? He asks. She's due in front of the CO subcommittee in conference room A at 5, and they don't like to be kept waiting. They'll wait for us. The SE is imperturbable. She needs to be fully briefed, Vikram. Fully briefed. Fully. Vic shakes his head. We could be here all week. Is she cleared? She is now. Dr. Armstrong looks at me. So does everyone else. I try not to sink into a puddle in my seat. We have Jez Wilson and Jerry Lockhart, both with bags under their eyes. Jez manages support and liaison ops, a euphemism that covers our friends from the Artists' Rifles in Hereford. Jerry is in charge of external assets, which, if this were a Bond movie, would be the 00 section. There's a woman I don't know by name, but associate with audit ops. Kindly face, twin set and pearls. An elderly fellow with a halo of flyaway hair. And a bushy Einsteinian moustache. And Emma McDougall from HR. The point is, everyone I recognize here deals with Mahogany Row, the organization's elite tier of semi-autonomous practitioners, on a daily basis. Some of them even have offices there. Which makes this a worryingly high-powered meeting.
Dominique, welcome to the Incorrigible Working Group, whose deliberations you are now on the approved list for. We're missing a few faces today. Angleton and Judith are terrible losses, so I'm afraid we're going to have to improvise a bit. Mr. Chowdhury.
Vikram clears his throat.
You have probably noticed we have a growing problem with paranormal vigilantes.
He begins, then stops and shrugs.
And hooligans like this morning's miscreant. I'm sorry. If not for last night's emergency,
You wouldn't have been in the firing line, but what's done is done, and the genie is out of the bottle.
The genie? Paranormal vigilantes? Incorrigible working group? What is this?
I shake my head. Allow me to recap.
Vic walks over to a trolley with a laptop and overhead projector mounted on it. There's a screen situated in front of the wall that I hadn't paid any attention to before. He fidgets with the laptop for a moment, then brings up a graph.
Case Nightmare Green began, let's see, 19 months ago?
A vertical dotted line appears near the left of the timeline.
We are here.
Another dotted line matches up the screen near the right-hand edge of the graph.
Here's one of the side effects. The frequency curve for paranormal incidents, defined as ordinary people who wake up one morning and discover they have acquired a talent for summonings and bindings, ritual magic, which they mistake for superpowers.
Oh dear. It's your classic growth curve. Starting low and staying low until about 3 months ago. Then it begins to double, and double again, rising fast, until it hits the dateline. Either the first quartile of a sigmoid curve or, don't go there, an exponential.
Until recently we were seeing perhaps 2 or 3 incidents per 10 million people per month, but we're now up to 1 per million and climbing. If we extrapolate forward, we get to here, says Vic.
Another graph, with the first one shrunk down to occupy the left-hand side of the screen.
If the growth rate doesn't show signs of slackening soon, if we are looking at a genuine exponential, it tends towards infinity in another 4 months, at which point we hit the, superhero singularity.
I can't seem to help myself. I know it's bad form, but I interrupt. Wait. Can you characterize these incidents? How serious are they?
Ah, that.
Vikram smiles ruefully.
It's a bit difficult. There seems to be a power law function covering the spread of abilities. Next slide.
He brings it on screen and yes, it shows a classic bell curve, a Gaussian distribution, with the left side cut off around the 80th percentile.
Here we are. Really minor anomalies don't show up at all. I mean, we've got no way of identifying a 4-year-old whose puppy always comes when she calls it, have we? Or a trawler man who can cull fishes, but is over quota and landing them illegally on the black market in Portugal. Now, a 15-year-old with the ability to control animals is a bit more obvious, especially if they attract attention by making a passing police horse tap dance for their friends. And at the other end of the bell curve, they stick out like a sore thumb. There was that business in Walthamstow last week, the, crazy cat lady.
I don't remember hearing about a crazy cat lady in Walthamstow last week, but I've been a bit too busy to bother with the newspapers or TV news for the past few months. Judging by the winces around the table, I must have missed out on something really extraordinarily noteworthy. I nod politely.
More disturbingly, there are the negative powers. Fang syndrome you know about. There are others. Being able to transform bits of your body into other objects might sound like a superpower, until you get it wrong. There's been an uptick in some really bizarre teratomas. Cancers that look like fully developed organs in inappropriate places. Human torches who lose self-control for even a second end up with a coroner delivering a narrative verdict of spontaneous human combustion. And there seems to be an association, as one would expect, between people with abilities to the right of the normal distribution and, Grandspark syndrome. We're already seeing the first rapid onset dementia cases, some as young as 13.
Oh, good grief. I think again. K syndrome is an unpleasant side effect of practicing ritual magic. If you solve the right theorems in your head, you can invoke various interesting extra-dimensional entities and make them do things. But there's a cost. Microscopic eaters phase in and out of our universe in response to the thaum fields generated in this way. And sometimes, some of them pause for long enough to take a microscopic bite out of your grey matter until you go insane on the brain, as Bob puts it. Once they get started, they tend to come back to the buffet. K syndrome is progressive, and the only way to stop it progressing is to stop practicing magic.
We believe the superpowers are a direct side effect of unconstrained background cognitive bandwidth processing. Bluntly, random people are thinking themselves into modes where they attract actor-agent entities and acquire various abilities. It's not yet obvious whether this is a true exponential or just a step function that will stabilize soon, but in the worst case, in another few months, almost everyone will be above the minimum threshold for ritual activation.
Oh dear, Emma McDougall says faintly, and fans herself with a notepad. That's really going to complicate our recruitment process.
I couldn't put it better myself.
I do not believe it is going to go that far,
Dr. Armstrong says calmly.
Professor Ford is preparing a report. Although he isn't willing to release it until he's triple-checked everything, he says that the step function model is most likely to hold true and that the rate of increase will taper off shortly. Something about there being no true singularities in nature outside of a black hole.
I take a deep breath and let it go slowly. If Mike Ford says it's so, then there's some reason for hope. He's our resident expert on Case Nightmare Green, the conjunction of stellar drift, the dreaming monkey population spike, and the computational singularity that is responsible for the surge in magic. If he's right, it's not the end of the world as we know it, just a very annoying new problem to deal with. He's been known to be wrong from time to time, but if he is, the prospect of everyone on the planet suddenly acquiring superpowers simply doesn't bear thinking about.
Yes, well, one may hope he's right again.
Vikram taps a key on the laptop.
Let me give you some examples. Annie Smith from Leicester, age 22, works in a Poundland store. Last Friday, robbers broke in through the loading bay as the manager was cashing up. They knew where the alarm cable run was located. The police are sure there was an inside accomplice, and they were attempting to make off with the previous 3 days' takings when Annie knocked them unconscious by bouncing them off the ceiling. Not the false ceiling, mind you, but the concrete ceiling 1.5 meters above the suspended tiles. Annie is 145 centimeters tall, 4 feet and 9 inches in old money, and weighs 50 kilos. They outweighed her 4-1. Then there's Geraldine Fawcett, 82, of Oakshot, who was taken to wearing fishnet hose and a merry widow, and fights late-night noise nuisances by. He goes on for another couple of increasingly surreal, not to say implausible, minutes, before the SA clears his throat pointedly. Yes. As you have already noted, we have limited time. Can I suggest we proceed to the psychological media profile problem next? If you insist.
Vikram pauses for long enough to take a mouthful of water from the glass in front of his place setting.
The reason we are seeing such a surge in Lycra futures is that ordinary people who know nothing about our business interpret their new abilities in terms of their pre-existing cognitive biases. A century ago, it would have been framed in terms of miracles and angels and devils. Witchcraft, in other words. But this is the 21st century in Britain, where the most rapidly growing religious demographic is none of the above. And for the past few decades, we've lived in a media environment where a particular fictional genre has been growing in popularity. I refer, of course, to the American superhero movie.
What about comics?
Asks the fellow with the flyaway hair. He seems enthused.
Surely Marvel and DC are somewhat to blame. I remember when they first arrived on these shores in the 1960s.
Yes, comics too, I suppose. But movies reach a bigger audience,
Vikram says wearily. He looks as if he's been back and forth over this ground until it's churned into mud.
Superman, Iron Man, Batman?
Fly away here, winces visibly.
You name it. Rich, powerful, white alpha males, who dress up in gimp suits and beat up ethnically diverse lower-class criminals. Reprehensible, lawless vigilantes. It would be so much easier if we had Greek or Roman gods and demigods to deal with instead. ACPO are spitting blood.
ACPO is the Association of Chief Police Officers, the not a trade union for supercops, that handles a lot of outsourced high-level policing policy work on behalf of the Home Office.
The Home Office hates vigilantes in Lycra fancy dress outfits almost as much as they hate lawbreakers. You see, superheroes don't follow the rules of evidence. They take procedural shortcuts, assault criminals, mess up crime scenes, and generally make it almost impossible to secure a conviction. Not to mention committing a basket load of offenses in their own right. Aggravated trespass, assault, violating controlled airspace, and flying without a license. Breaking and entering, criminal damage.
Oh. Oh. I finger a simple cord on my blotter, then realize that Jerry Lockhart is staring at my hand with an expression of deep distaste, and force myself to stop fidgeting. John Bloody Williams. Why do I have to be earwormed by the first violin's theme from Superman right now? Are any of them attributing it to magic? I ask.
Yes, some. Vikram frowns. But it's currently running at less than 20%. Superhero is the dominant paradigm, and new fish tend to swim with the school. Why do you ask?
Well, let's see. Am I right in thinking that the nature of the incorrigible problem is that we are dealing with a plague of untrained occult practitioners who are interpreting their somewhat random skills as superhero abilities? Vikram nods, but the senior auditor takes it upon himself to reply.
Essentially, yes, you've nailed it. But there's more to it than that. Jez?
Vikram takes a seat, as Jez Wilson nods, and picks up the thread.
The real problem isn't just identification and suppression, Dr. O'Brien. The real problem is that it's too public. It caught us in the op, and now the news media have sensitized so they're picking it up everywhere. The usual press chorus, something must be done, is already tuning up. The business this morning is just the latest and worst case. And your showing up on camera may actually be a blessing in disguise, because we need to find a way to get in front of the situation and take overt action to bring the paranormally enhanced under control. Otherwise, we're going to be run ragged dealing with this nonsense, rather than focusing on the organization's core mission.
There is a chirp from the SA's suit pocket. Then another chirp. The discreet mating call of the mobile phone. That the senior auditor carries a mobile phone at all, let alone that he doesn't silence it in meetings, is so extraordinary a revelation that I stare. But then something even stranger happens. He pulls it out. A rather ancient BlackBerry, plastic edges polished to a shine by constant use. And answers it. Right in front of our shocked faces. In, as I said, a highly sensitive meeting.
Hello? I'm in the incorrigible session, didn't I say I wasn't to be...
Oh. I see. A pause.
He insists, does he? Damn. Yes, I'll tell them.
He puts his phone away and frowns.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut this short, ladies and gentlemen. They've brought the meeting forward an hour. Dr. O'Brien, Agent Candid. He nods at me. As you can see, our organization has been dragged into dangerously close proximity to the public sphere by the incorrigible problem. In particular, Mahogany Row are desperately keen to stay out of the limelight. So, in order to avoid compromising our core mission, we need to generate a semi-classified proxy to deal with the superhero problem.
Dominique? I tense. His use of my first name is unusual enough to put my adrenal glands on fight or flee alert,
The narrative we are developing is that there is a secret department within the security service, better known to members of the public as MI5, which deals with superpowered threats to the realm. As your cover has been comprehensively blown by this morning's events, I have decided that it is necessary to place Agent Candid on indefinite furlough. I'm afraid I gasp involuntarily. I manage to suppress the flinch reflex. Agent Candid is my operational designation. Worse, it has framed my working life for the past several years. Part-time academic by day, part-time laundry researcher and active service operative by night, an occasional on-call executioner. The senior auditor rolls on, pretending not to notice my lapse. Meanwhile, we want you, that is Dr. Dominique O'Brien, to become the semi-public face of Operation Incorrigible. Semi-public in this context means that you will interact directly with other government agencies. Your cover story is that you are a senior member of the aforementioned secret department of MI5, answering to the Home Office, where you will recruit and operate an, superhero team to, fight crime. You will appear to report to the regular security service authorities, and your department will identify and execute suitable responses to the anomalous power threat. Fighting crime is the cover story for the BBC and national news media. The internal narrative within other civil service departments, and for open dissemination within MI5 and the police, is that your primary objective is to put the frighteners on the pervert suits. Compliant ones will be recruited and corralled in a safe organisational framework that provides them with plenty of opportunities for make-believe superhero work. Non-compliant ones can be taken down in public if necessary, without compromising the operational security of designated national security agencies. We anticipate full and enthusiastic support for this goal from the police and the security service, because this strategy feeds into their operational goals, and all they're required to do is to claim credit for your hard work. But those are merely your tertiary and secondary tasks. Your primary objective is to insulate the laundry from public exposure and consequential political meddling by directing media attention away from us and towards the antics of the official government superhero team, working for this fictional department within the security service. His smile is terrifying. In other words, think of yourself as James Bond's M, if Bond had a cape. No such organization exists, I protest, horrified. I've got to battle supervillains in public. Worse, I'm working for the Home Office. The laundry is part of the security services, answerable to the Ministry of Defense, while the Home Office is all about law enforcement. Two cultures doesn't even begin to describe the scale of the divide. The organisation you will be in charge of exists as of now, at least on paper. The SE's smile is fee. Mrs. McDougal, the dossier, if you please. Emma gives me a sympathetic look as she slides a 10-centimetre-thick dossier across the table towards me. Sorry, dear, she says. I'm afraid you're promoted sideways. Better read quickly, the senior auditor adds. Because that phone call was the Chief Secretary to the Cabinet Office. They're expecting you in Cabinet Office Briefing Room A in 42 minutes precisely. Just in time to update the Deputy Prime Minister on your new assignment. I thought I'd hit rock bottom on my way into the Admiralty Building. Little did I suspect how much further there was to sink. Emma's dossier is a doozy. If it's to be believed, I have been promoted 3 whole grades in a single bound. I am now attached to the org chart of the sprawling bureaucratic empire popularly misidentified as MI5, about 3 management tiers down from the top, and so far off to one side that I'm teetering on the edge of a virtual cliff, with dotted lines leading off the edge of the paper in the direction
of the iceberg, labelled Home Office. And what a view this cliff overlooks. I have no less than 5 sub-departments under me, and something like 40 staff. But it's a skeleton crew for now. Their niches on the org chart are all blank for the time being. A tabula rasa labelled, insert recruit here. Half of them are tagged superhero. I have a budget of $3 million a year, an open requisition for a secret bunker, and a team headquarters, subject to authorization, approval, and planning permission. And an entire backstory to memorize for my decades-old career as some kind of high-level counter-espionage expert. It's utterly humiliating. That's what it is. What I really wanted and expected was to receive my entirely justified bollocking behind closed doors, then to go home and take a month of garden leave and several sessions with a security-cleared therapist and maybe a talk with a marriage guidance counsellor. Not to mention a discreet word with Emma about commencing the search for a suitable candidate to take over a certain bone-white cross that I bear. It's a long shot, but it just might work. Although the search might take a while to bear fruit. Instead, they seem to think they're doing me a favour by promoting me, dumping a huge load of unfamiliar management responsibilities on my shoulders, and putting me in charge of my very own department, in another organisation to boot. Once my speed reading session with the dossier runs out of time, they form a protective phalanx around me, and march me in bureaucratic lockstep down marble corridors and the pavement alongside Whitehall, past the Scotland office, onto the front steps of the Cabinet Office building. Or maybe they're just making sure I have no opportunity to escape before the ritual feeding of the newly commissioned departmental director to the ministers. As I climb the steps and present my ID to the policeman on duty, all I can think of is a silly book that Bob told me he was reading a couple of years ago, by some dead famous author who came up with a clever neologism. What was it? An out-of-concept problem? No. An out-of-context problem. Something which organisations or cultures encounter in very much the same way that a sentence encounters a full stop. I can't shake the sense that today is my very own hyper-personalised out-of-context problem. I talk to my violin in the privacy of my own head, fine. When my violin talks back and tries to use me as a puppet to murder my husband, that's not so fine. When I go on to nearly kill a man in the middle of Trafalgar Square, live on network TV, that's even less fine. But then, there's this. What should I expect next if the day continues to go downhill at this rate? An invading army of elves for after-dinner amusement? I'm so wrapped up in myself that I nearly walk into a familiar-looking man in a rumpled suit, clutching a battered red leather file box under one arm. I flinch violently and nearly push Lecter's quick-release button by accident. Whoops, sorry, I say, trying to force my heart back down into my chest where it belongs. Not to... He does a double take, noticing my violin case. Ah, you must be the star of the show. He offers me a handshake. I accept it instinctively. Jolly good. See you later, mustache. And with that, the Justice Minister, number 5 in the cabinet, deftly sidesteps around me, body swerves between Vic and the senior auditor, and barrels down the front steps. Oh dear God. I've fallen into the thick of it. Was that? Vikram asks faintly.
Stiff upper lip,
murmurs Dr. Armstrong.
Yes, it was. If you'd like to go in, Dr. O'Brien, they'll be expecting you. We'll be back to pick you up at 6 when the meeting's over.
I will not show fear. I smile at him, baring my teeth like a good little girl. Looking forward to it. Then I enter the Dragon's Den. Cobra is Cabinet Office Briefing Room A, on the first floor of the Cabinet Office building on Whitehall. Contrary to media folklore, there is no such thing as the Cobra Committee. That implies an implausible level of permanence. Cobra is simply the place where ministers and senior civil servants meet to be briefed on, assess, and respond to civil and military emergencies. It may be on the first floor rather than in a reinforced bunker, but there are no windows in Cobra's reinforced walls, and the whole section of the building is surrounded by not one, but two Faraday cages, and an airlock tunnel lined with metal detectors and other sensors. Naturally, there are discrete security checkpoints that make your typical airport boarding experience look like it's run by Larry, Moe and Curly. And the whole building is contained within the security cordon that embraces Downing Street, much of Whitehall, and the Houses of Parliament. On my way into Cobra, they take my handbag and phone. They don't take my earrings or necklace, but they check them over with handheld emission detectors. As for Lecter, he's just going to have to get used to the hand searches. The quick release springs in his case worry them. But in the end, we reach a tense compromise. After they x-ray and manually examine him, I leave him in a security locker, along with my handbag and phone, but they let me take both the keys to the locker. It's funny. I'm fully dressed, but I feel naked without my violin. The briefing room itself is nearly filled by a thoroughly modern bleached pine boardroom table. One wall is a solid slab of TV screens, and there are charge points for laptops and tablets on the table. Internet too, I gather, but not for the likes of me. Requests for access have to be cleared in advance by CESG. Today's session is chaired by the Deputy Prime Minister, a last-minute substitution due to the Big Cheese himself being distracted by an opportunity to be seen rubbing snouts with his frenemy the Mayor by whatever proportion of the populace still bother watching the news at 9. Also in attendance are Barry Jennings, the avuncular Justice Minister I nearly ran down earlier, and Jessica Green, the Home Secretary. Lady High Executioner and pin-up girl for the hanging's too good for them electoral demographic. Footnote. Actually, such tabloid caricatures are rather poor representations of the reality. They're all charming, personable, extremely sharp individuals who are terrifyingly well-informed about the workings of their departments. You don't get to the top table of a government, any government, without being an overachiever. This doesn't mean I'd vote or not vote for them. As ministers, it's their duty to toe the line with respect to the governing party's policy platform. And I'm not the kind of girl who'll vote for a friendly dude I'd like to share a beer with if I happen to suspect that he'd quite like to invade Poland. But I find it faintly reassuring to confirm that, however misguided I might privately think some of our government's policies might be, at least they are being executed with enthusiasm and zeal by first-class overachievers. Because it beats the alternative. In addition to the political heavies, there's a small coterie of lower-level drones and minor flappers. The Commissioner of Police, London's Copper-in-Chief, a female assistant commissioner attending on behalf of ACPO, the Association of Chief Police Officers, the Chief Secretary to the Cabinet Office, representatives from the Prison Service, and so on. It's all a bit intimidating. I feel like a secondary school football coach who's been summoned to a meeting of the Premier League chairman, who are, of course, very busy men, and want you to know it. Dr. O'Brien! The Deputy PM starts up smoothly without any social lubrication. Can you tell us exactly what happened in Trafalgar Square this morning? I stand up and deliver the cover story that the incorrigible committee sweated their skulls over for me while I was heading home for a quick change and shower at lunchtime. I am used to giving lectures. This is no different, I tell myself. I can't be suffering from stage fright, can I? I've done this thousands of times before, just to different audiences. I recall a trick I used to use at unfamiliar academic conferences, where I pretend I'm addressing a room full of sapient cauliflowers from Arcturus. It's less nerve-wracking than lecturing some of the most powerful civil servants and policymakers in the land, so I do that. It does indeed make everything easier, except for a slight tendency to get distracted. Bob really doesn't like brassicas. Even the smell upsets him, which leads to a hypnagogic vision of my husband choking as he tries to eat the deputy prison minister's head. High points. I run a very small, very new department within MI5, which keeps tabs on superheroes and supervillains. Sometimes the two are easy to tell apart. Sometimes they're indistinguishable. The number of them crawling out of the woodwork is increasing. I myself have some small talent in that direction. I happened to be in town on my day off when the Trafalgar Square incident kicked off. Yes, my department works with the Metropolitan Police. Together, we fight crime. I am at the end of my canned spiel, congratulating myself on a message well delivered, when the Home Secretary herself fixes me with a brooding, brown-eyed stare. Dr. O'Brien, what you've outlined to us is a purely reactive stance, but this incident isn't an isolated event. We can't afford to be on the back foot. The terrorism implications are dreadful. Where's your strategy to get ahead of the problem? It's coming. I swallow. With all due respect, I was called to this briefing at short notice. My department is in fact working overtime on a broad strategy for managing the superpowered. Unfortunately, we currently have neither the budget nor the enabling legislative framework to implement the plan, but you'll have it on my desk by 9 a.m. sharp next Monday morning. She doesn't smile. Jessica Green only opens wide to swallow her prey. You will personally brief my staff later that day, subject to scheduling. Yes, ma'am, I say automatically. I don't think a heel click would be appreciated, but is there anything else? No, she says dismissively. I think we've heard all we... The red telephone next to the deputy PM's elbow trills for attention. Yeah. Deputy Prime Minister Dennis Baker, at age 41, the head of the junior party in the coalition, and one of the most powerful politicians in the country, actually yas. He does it with the indolent, satisfied smirk of the utterly entitled. Then something odd happens. He stiffens, an expression of sudden urgency wiping the grin from his features. Oh dear! How unfortunate! What? Another pause, during which all of us try to pretend we're not holding our breath in hope of learning what could set Golden Boy's face in such a severe rictus of dismay. Oh dear! That's really rather serious, isn't it? Yes. I can see why you felt it necessary to interrupt. Yes, I'll tell them. Keep me informed of any developments. Yes. Bye. He puts the phone down, then leans forward and plants his hands, palm down, on either side of his blotter for a moment. For a moment, he struggles visibly for words. Where is Officer Friendly when you need him? He finally bursts out. Then he takes a deep breath and uses the moment to get a grip on himself. I apologize, ladies and gentlemen. It appears that the incident in Trafalgar Square may have been a diversion. What? That's my contribution to the sudden uproar. While Dr. O'Brien was defending our friend the mayor from Stripjack Sprat, in front of the cameras around the fourth plinth, somebody broke into the Bank of England. They broke into the Bank of England vaults, I repeat later that evening. Crowbarred their way into one of the secure terminals and downloaded the private keys to the currency serialization printer. Vikram, who are they? Emma, what's a currency serialization printer? We're in a private room at the Civil Service Club, a couple of blocks away from the Cabinet Office. Our booking on the room in Admiralty House ran out, and the new annex is still out of service. So the senior auditor personally signed us into the club and agreed to a subsistence claim. Which is a good thing, because I am shaky and ravenous with hunger. I haven't eaten properly since before last night's reception on the oil rig. I push my hair back. Isolated strands are making individual bids for freedom from the knot I imposed on them after I showered, and wet my lips before I reply. It's a really nice Beaujolais. The SA has good taste in wine. Nobody knows who they are, which is in itself highly suspicious, I explain. The cameras saw nothing. Literally nothing. The recording isn't blank, it just shows what you'd expect to see in a room with nobody there, until suddenly there's an explosion and bits of computer and broken glass and ceiling tiles all over the floor.
Do go on.
Dr. Armstrong's spectacles twinkle. Reflections from the candles in the middle of the table. They broke into the vault, where they keep the secure computer system the bank uses to generate the numbers on banknotes. It's an anti-forgery measure. The serial numbers aren't purely sequential, and they aren't random. They're actually a sequence number and a cryptographic hash function generated by a very private key indeed. Banks can use a copy of the B of E's public key to verify that high-denomination notes aren't forgeries. It's a backstop. Even if an enterprising crook can get a hold of a supply of the right paper and ink, beg, borrow, or steal a secure hologram-capable intaglio printer, and manufacture currency plates, they still have to get the number right. I thought they used RFID chips these days, says Jez Wilson. And DNA? The DNA tagging hasn't been rolled out yet. When it is, it can be sampled and amplified by PCR to authenticate the new banknotes. RFID chips, not for anything small, they're too expensive. Eurozone issuers use RFID chips in 50 euro notes and up, but the Bank of England doesn't do that yet. The key security measure is still the cryptographic checksum in the machine-readable number.
So they stole what, the private key?
Not known. I take another sip of wine. What we do know is that they ran off a couple of tapes full of signed serialized numbers. At least, that's what the Treasury people are saying they think happened. All the room contains is a terminal and a pair of mini-computers old enough to vote, and with all but two of their I.O. ports soldered shut. They generate sequences and dump them onto magnetic tape, which is then transported under guard to a secure banknote printing site, loaded onto the printing station that adds the serial numbers, and then degaussed on the spot to prevent the tape being reused.
How do they know the tapes were taken?
There's a mechanical rev counter inside the tape drive they use. Not visible if you're looking at the front panel. It's all very old school. They open it up every week and write down the number of tapes that have been written in a ledger. Apparently someone ran off a couple of reels of £20 notes. Each tape can store 1 million valid currency numbers, so they're good for £20 million of perfect forgeries per cartridge. They left behind an EMP bomb. A shaped implosion charge wrapped around a small electromagnetic coil. It made a mess of the room and, more importantly, fried every chip, hard drive, tape and floppy disk within 20 metres. That's when the security guards noticed. There was a bone-rattling thump from the basement and their mobile phones died.
Charming,
murmurs the SA.
So they've got no idea who did it, except that the culprits knew exactly what they were doing, could bamboozle TV cameras, and got away with a couple of incredibly portable items that are worth £20 million each. What makes them think it's connected with Strip Jack Spratt's song and dance session?
Well, there are two clues to work on. This calls for another sip of wine. Firstly, as near as we can tell, the break-in happened at exactly the same time that Jack started building his pornographic sculpture on the fourth plinth. It might be a pure coincidence, but what are the odds? And secondly, I pause for another sip. The thief left a calling card. The SE winces almost imperceptibly.
What did it say?
he asks, clearly nerving himself for bad news. It said, "The world shall hear from me again. Tremble, fools, before it is too late. Professor Freudstein." And it was printed in Comic Sans. So,